welcome to episode 33 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. So this is going to be a shorter one.
It is.
And it's late.
It is very
and
late.
And we're super winging it. And I'm late putting out the... Oh, I don't even have my calendar up. Your blog I've had since for like a week.
Yeah.
Haven't put that up.
Which is usually, I should say, in reverse, where I'm a little late getting the blog to you. So it makes me feel like I'm ahead of the curve right now.
And I haven't written my blog entry, and it was due last Sunday.
Oh, dear. Man. So this is April 16th, 2016.
We're supposed to record on the 7th.
Right. That's correct.
Except I was in Texas.
Yeah.
At the ARDF, the U.S. Championships.
Do you want to start with that?
In Killeen. We usually do technology type stuff at the end.
Okay.
We usually do science and then go more and more to our stuff, so...
Right.
Unless you want to change that.
We had
this discussion.
No, we aren't having this discussion.
We're not having this discussion. Because I'm totally open. But you have to decide and so that I can get my stuff in order.
Yeah. Okay. So.
So the administrative stuff is that everything is late. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be because, well, I had to finish up the results for the O-meet. Mm-hmm. And now we have two more meets coming up soon. So I'm trying to get stuff done for
them. They're going to be ARDF meets.
Yeah. Yeah, with the school kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're not open for everybody. School events. It might all be jumbled because I've just barely had time to look over what I have, and I haven't looked at any of your stuff.
Okay.
So you pick something.
I was just about to say, how about we start with you? Because I've looked at a bit of your stuff, and I can piece my stuff in around it.
So I guess the most physics-type stuff, I don't have any, actually.
I don't have any physics-type stuff this time.
So go right to, like, chemistry, biology. I don't know.
Okay.
Actually, I have tech-type stuff. That should all go together at the end, I suppose.
Okay.
So, straight to biology?
Definitely.
Okay. So one article that I looked at, this was before leaving, so that was like almost 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the synthesis of a minimal bacterial genome. So
right.
Imagine the... trying to come up with a synthetic genome. You've created every gene and you try to make it as small as possible to see what's possible. And this is a project that Venter, the guy from... you remember there was the Human Genome Project and then there was the other project that was also trying to do the human genome, but it was... privately funded, and he was the head of that.
Right.
Or that's the way that's where I remember him from. And so he started on this new one. The article is out of March 25th, Science, I think. Yeah. And I read quite a bit out of this, but it's so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I am just going to mention one thing that, or a couple of things that I thought were interesting that I still remember. It's really not obvious what constitutes. So this minimal genome that's going to be synthetic, mm-hmm. you figure, well, you just keep removing genes, and then when you get to the bacterium that surviving, then you know you've gone too far and you back off. It's way more a decision about what you want at the time for two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, as you remove genes, you find that there's you get down to a certain number, and then depending on what choices you make, other genes may or may not be absolutely necessary.
Okay.
So in other words, you might have three genes. None of them are absolutely necessary, but you can't lose all three or you'll die.
Right.
Because there's multiple ways to get certain intermediates in biochemical pathways and the end products right. you might absolutely need, but there's different ways to... So that's number one. And then number two, you also have to decide, well, what does it mean to have a minimal genome? Because you can keep paring it down, and what you find is you don't suddenly have a creature, a bacterium that's unviable. It just starts to grow slower and slower and slower to a point where it's just barely staying alive, and you're working with, well, under what conditions will this just die off because of chance, thermodynamics? It's really basically not growing, just one mm-hmm. division every, I don't know how long, and by chance it'll die or survive. So they made some decision about a particular doubling rate for the mm-hmm. bacterium in a really minimal medium and said, okay, if we can get this growth rate, then we'll call it our minimum genome if we can't remove any more genes. But if it grows slower than that, we're really not going to consider it
right.
Viable. And, you know, all of this is this genetic, these changes in the genetics of the bacterium have everything to do with trying to understand the biochemistry rather than the genetics.
Right.
What set of enzymes you put together to form the very basics that you need for something to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can get down to that, then you can start to see, well, how do I change it and add to it to make the organism do what I want?
Okay.
Go ahead.
So they did actually, they were able to create a replicating bacteria.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the other way around. They started with one that was replicating, and they kept taking stuff out.
Okay.
Right? And I don't remember exactly the strategy, but I think one of the things they did is they allow the bacterium to grow and have many cell divisions mm-hmm. in a minimal medium and then see what survives and then sequence that and mm-hmm. see what it kept and what changed. And then they designed from scratch the next one from what they learned from that one and then put it back in. So
did they talk about how long this took? Like how many years have they been doing this?
Well, I remember a while back there was another article. They'd made a big step forward.
Okay.
So let me see. They have a timeline in the article, which was really interesting, but I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, that's fine. It was just my own curiosity.
Yep. So, and it's on page... Oh, I can't find the page because I downloaded the PDF and... Oh, 1414 of the March 25th issue.
Mm-hmm. Neat.
Yeah, it's a really interesting problem.
It is.
So
it's, I'm just, you know, it's one of those things. It's, that's pretty cool.
Stick with biology type stuff?
Okay.
Or do you have one that's more?
So I have one that will probably match with that. So, there's been a new development in, using CRISPR to edit mushrooms. So they were editing parts of the mushroom that were causing them to go brown early. And it is actually the first CRISPR-edited organism that the United States is considering putting on the market for foods.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's
so
interesting.
It's just interesting. You know, we have this great technology.
So it's in mushrooms.
Yeah, and it's to they edited out the stuff that the genetic component that leads to browning, early browning of the mushrooms. So
when I was at the ARDF championships, Laurie Huberman was there.
Yeah.
And she does research. She's in California. She does research on it's a form of fungi. Neurocrassa, I think. I'm not sure. I know it's not Saccharomyces cerevisiae. She said she'd done some research in the past on that. The one she's working on now is a filamentous type fungus. And she was, the topic of CRISPR came up, and she was saying that they've had really tough times with getting CRISPR to work in fungus.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
But. In this particular one, it did work, but it's going to be a bit for it to be accepted on the, before we'll see it in our grocery aisles. So it's just interesting that they're starting to use it, you know, as ways of, in our food stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So that was one of mine. And then, I got on to parasites. There were two articles on parasites that caught my eye. One is talking about parasites and or parasitic worms.
Before we go off of CRISPR.
Yep.
So you remember the news that there's a Chinese group that did another human embryo editing in CRISPR. I didn't have a chance to look at that. I only heard about it 2 days ago.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to look at either, and I wanted to see what they had done.
And although it sounds really similar to the last one.
Right.
They were targeting a totally different protein. It was one involved in AIDS, but the whole safe moral issue and stuff was handled the same way. Embryos killed within 3 days. Only used ones that had
non-viable.
An extra chromosome from that were going to be thrown out from a donor bank. Yeah, and I didn't read anything, but I assume that they found the same type of off-target effects, and like you'd expect. You know.
Yeah, and I did want to read more about that, but I hadn't gotten to it yet.
Anyway, so back to yours.
Okay.
We've done our CRISPR duties.
Yep, our CRISPR duties. So there's a parasite worm that may prevent Crohn's disease by altering the bacteria. And it's kind of interesting the way they found it. They were researching a group, and now I'm trying to find where it is. And they found that the people that were infected with the parasites had much lower or lower cases of Crohn's disease. The inflammation. Yes. And for some reason it helps with the mucus.
Yeah, okay.
And helping to create that mucus lining of the intestine.
So, I mean, I don't know, but it seems like if you've one of the things that parasites do is they try to reduce the inflammation around them because they don't want to be attacked.
So that might be part of it.
And these are inflammatory diseases in the bowel. And so having a parasite there, that might be one mechanism.
Right. There's a lot more research that needs to be done. They did actually give eggs of the parasites to people with Crohn's and saw what the outcome was.
These are like non-viable
30% had some effect, but the others had no effect. So there's a lot more research that have to be done. So let's see.
This was news out of Science?
Yes.
Yeah. But not out of the journal.
Right. It will probably be coming to the journal.
Yeah, one of those that they always put.
Two recent clinical trials of the Helminth treatment of Crohn's disease, in which participants drank a solution containing the worm's eggs, stopped early because the results were disappointing. And so they said, you know, just being infected with these parasites isn't going to guarantee that.
Well, just being exposed to the eggs.
Yeah.
I assume they weren't actually infected. They were giving them non-viable eggs.
Yeah. I don't know.
And then hoping that...
Yeah. It wasn't clear in the article, but I bet you're right. And then another one that was very strange.
What is that?
It is another intestinal worm that may help women get pregnant more often. So it's this...
The picture looks really weird.
It does. It's like you see these three things, probably suckers, that adhere to your intestine.
Or like a tri-tooth.
Yeah, tri-tooth.
What's the parasite?
Well, I was just going down. It's a Ascaris. Ascaris.
Well, those become huge.
They do.
Aren't they the ones that
So
70 centimeters long or something?
Yeah, 36 centimeters, 14 inches long.
So still huge. Yeah.
So they're huge. And they found that in these groups that they studied of women, that some cases this particular parasite increased the rate of births.
Mm-hmm.
And it was by 2 children over a population of, you know, 1,000 women that were studied. So it was like, whoa, that's scary.
I wonder what the mechanism is.
And then they found another parasite, another type of Ascaris that, there's the Ascaris, made 2 more per lifetime kids. But then they found another one, and they found that it actually reduced the number of births. So it somehow affected the fertility of these women, either in a positive way that they had more kids, or they decreased the number of kids they had. So it was an interesting article. I look forward to reading it in Science when it comes out. And it'll just be interesting to see what happens. So that's my parasitology for probably the year.
Yeah, so you've been really big on vaccination and stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the next one.
Okay, that sounds great.
There's an outbreak of yellow fever in southwestern Africa. This is from a report out of the April 8th issue of Science. It's on page 128. It's a news story. And it's really scary because I don't remember the stats, but most people don't get symptoms that are too bad, but of the ones that develop serious symptoms, mortality rate out of that group is about 1/3. And I don't know if it's like 10% or so that get those more severe symptoms. So when you're looking at populations in the millions, that becomes a health nightmare.
Yeah.
And there's only a few places in the world that make the vaccine, and there's no treatment. So basically, if you have an outbreak, you just make sure you have extra vaccine going to those places, and it's always been contained. This outbreak's been so bad they just ran out, and they're starting to see it show up in a few other places. And the making the vaccine does not scale up very well. It's one of those where you use chicken eggs, and you have to grow the eggs and isolate the virus out of there and attenuate it. Or maybe it's genetically engineered to be attenuated. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the point is, the world supply is basically gone. The store, the stock. And we don't totally understand why, but Africa is the worst for yellow fever endemism, if that's a word.
Mm-hmm.
South America is also has it, but East Asia doesn't seem to have it very much. for some unknown reason. But the mosquito that transmits it does have it. And they were trying to contain it in Angola and some of the surrounding areas where this epidemic's happened. And they've already found people all over that have traveled out of that area and have been infected. And they've even found one in Beijing. Now, the mosquito, it's one of the Aedes aegypti. There's no Aedes aegypti in Beijing. So, you know, it's not, that's a dead end for the virus there. It is a virus, isn't it? Yellow fever?
I think so.
Anyway, but southern China and a lot of the rest of Asia does have that mosquito. And so maybe there's something else happening in that region that makes it that it's just not going to be able to maintain itself in Asia. But it doesn't seem like there's any reason it shouldn't. And it might just as easily be that there's been geographical blocks for it to be transmitted
right
in that direction. And now that they're going there, and there's no vaccine around anymore, and there won't be for months, that you might be looking at some populations that are under severe danger of being exposed to epidemics. So, yeah, it's, anyway, that's all I had from it. So.
That's really scary.
If the research on, you know, what causes the outbreaks and what happens where it is increased, that'll be interesting to see how Asia is different.
Yeah.
Or if it is. And, what'd they find?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not very sciencey. That's more social type stuff. But, you know, interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, where to go next? Let's see.
You want to do the slaughter at the bridge?
Well, I have a Viking one. Maybe I'll do my Viking one first, because mine's very short.
Okay.
So there's this Viking thing that...
This is another news.
Yeah, it's another news. Oh, there we go. There's this Vikings may have the first taken to seas to find women and slaves. And... this was just published in April 15th, 2016, and it's by...
But it's a post.
It's a news post, yeah, from Science News, pardon me. And basically, it's just announcing that they have this $6 million grant for a research project looking at the coast, the English coast, and looking to understand what's going on. And Neil Price of Sweden will be leading the research. So it's just about to start. And he said that, you know, their first findings of these two boats indicate that they were actually moving out much earlier than they first thought to get.
These are boats that they discovered in England?
Yeah, in England on the coast.
And they date from 700 something?
Already? Yeah, so that they actually were moving out from their areas much earlier than they had originally thought. And so his new research grant will be looking into that. And they haven't found that much yet. They're just starting out. So that's all. It was just it was neat to see that.
So more archaeology.
More archaeology.
This one's really amazingly cool.
Yeah.
This one was published as a news feature out of Science on March 25th. And the article, I love the name, Slaughter at the Bridge. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the year, I don't know, 1200 BC, something like this. And this is a time when there's the Bronze Age in full swing in Southern Europe and in the Levant, but not in Northern Europe. I mean, there's bronze there, but it's just starting. And how should we handle this? Like, what happened then, or how it was discovered?
How it was discovered, so, and then what happened.
This is
just such a cool story.
North in Germany? Is it Germany or Netherlands? It's Germany, I think. I can't remember.
I'm looking.
Anyway, it's a river far north on the north coast of one of those countries. And in the
Northern Europe.
Yeah. Anyway, in the 1990s, I think, some guy found a bone sticking out of the side of a riverbank with a flint arrowhead sticking into it, and that started the research going. And all along the river, they've been finding bodies all over the place from this period. And they're pretty sure they're all from just a period of a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's possibly the signs. I think they have several hundred. I can't remember. I mean, this was before the Texas trip again. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing a lot from memory. But they estimate from what they see that several thousand people were there. And what this totally changes. Oh, what do you have here?
Northern German state.
Mecklenburg.
Vorpommern.
Pommern. Anyway, it's on the Baltic, the river.
Yeah.
So they think, okay, several thousand people came here. And from what they were carrying, they're deducing that a lot of these people were actually warriors. And this doesn't match at all with the theory up to now about what Europe was back then. The concept was, well, you have these isolated farms kind of all over, the population density is extremely low, and you really don't have like little cities or anything like that because there's no evidence for them. And so you don't have armies. And yeah, you might have tribes that like a few guys get together and attack the neighboring tribe and stuff, but you don't really have these big wars. And here we have a river that at that time, you have several thousand people that came together. Some of them are obviously not farmers, like a large portion of them are not farmers. And what else is special? And from starting to do genetics on it, this is ongoing, like from teeth and stuff, a lot of them from very far.
Wow.
So when does that have to be mean? If you have soldiers that came from far, and they're not necessarily from the south, right? Some of them are from the east or from the west. If you have soldiers, that means you have armies.
Mm-hmm.
And you need training, which means these are being controlled by some political entity.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells them where to go and stuff, and has able to manage enough resources to get thousands of these people to this one place.
Right.
One side against the other. So it really, and at the time, there was no writing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing that's written about this battle. There's no evidence of it in the records from nations in the south that had developed writing. But if you look at, for example, I mean, I don't remember. I don't know if they ever talked about the Hittites, but I think I remember a long time ago reading about the Hittites compared to the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians, where we know from the Egyptian and the Mesopotamian written records that they had these big battles, they came in and stuff. But if you look at where they were from, there's no evidence there of them having gone on and fought battles and stuff.
Right.
Because they didn't write anything down.
Right.
And yet, not writing anything down, they still were able to have these big civilizations that went off and took down other civilizations.
Right. They talked about having a 120-meter long bridge.
There's evidence in one place where the ground is different, where they think there was a bridge, and it's something that must have been constructed,
I
think, because there's solid things.
Solid like stones and wood parts,
So they think that there was migrations
or wooden posts, I should say,
Europe, and that probably this was a bottleneck. And that's why the fight happened there, is because it became an important strategic place. You know, but this is totally guessing, because there's nothing ever written. Soon after the battle, you start to have signs of larger towns and stuff. So one theory is that this is the very beginning of when civilization was forming more centralized structures. And this was like the very first battle between these forming states of the North.
You kind of wonder if people had to leave, or it was a fight over some people having to migrate south for better lands or something, and other people holding them off. But who knows?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like there might have been...
They were thinking it was a migration east-west control rather than north-south.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing is the reason they know that the battle happened all in a short time, and this was not a war that was going on with few people lasting like 5 years, is that the people there have some scars on them that have totally healed.
Right.
And they're definitely battle-type scars.
Right.
So they must be soldiers, because they have scars that healed, and you know, they're in fights.
Right, right.
And then they have evidence of ways they were killed. But they do not have partially healed scars.
Oh, interesting.
And if you don't have a partially healed scar on anybody, it means you don't have people that went there, got hurt, hung around, and were part of the next battle and then died. Right?
Yeah.
All the scars must have happened somewhere else. And this happened all in a short time, and everybody who died ended up in either carried away or left, the body was left there, which they thought the bodies were thrown in the river. Mm-hmm. And
they said they had no gnaw marks on them.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
Because they think that it was a time when the bogs around the river were forming very quickly.
Got it. Okay.
And so they threw the bodies in the...
I was like, how can they keep these bodies covered so that they can't...
So they think that the bodies got thrown in the river and got covered. It was very, they think...
Boggy area to start with.
And silty.
Yeah.
So they got covered very fast.
God.
And...
That makes sense to me now.
There's two different types of people, so to speak, you find. Mm-hmm. You have fine people that have no clothes whatsoever, no armor or anything, and they're in what they think are shallow areas, and ones that do have armor in deeper areas, but no clothes, from what I'm remembering. They think the clothes in that type of chemistry deteriorated.
Oh, okay.
The people that were thrown in the shallower areas have nothing because they got looted.
Yeah.
The ones that got thrown in the deeper areas, you still have the metal parts.
Because no one could dig.
Because you couldn't get that far down. It was several meters down. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, or you wouldn't know they were there like
three or four
days later, because the waters got that black look or whatever.
The tannin.
So.
Yeah. Oh, what a crazy, crazy.
Yeah, it was a cool article.
Like, it's not the full story. That's why I was about to say, what a crazy story. But you have no idea what truly happened other than you have all of these pieces that have to be put together. It'll be interesting to see what they find and if they get more of the story put together.
Especially the genetic part of this is going on. They're definitely doing
so. They'll be able to identify what regions these people were from.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah. And from the preliminary stuff, they already know that some of them came from pretty far.
So bizarre.
Yep,
ancient DNA. Neat.
Okay, this was going to be a super short one, and we're already at 35 minutes. Totally not really saying I'm upset about it, but it's like, this is just amazing. Mm-hmm. I thought we had nothing to talk about.
I know. Do you have other articles that aren't technology or...
Well, that's all I have left for this tech type stuff.
See, that's...
No science left.
I only have the tech stuff left. Okay.
I have something before we go to Trilogue.
Okay. You do the before the Trilogue.
Okay.
And then I'll follow up with the Trilogue.
So this is a more recent article. It was published April 1st in Science. And it's a way of synthesizing pharmaceuticals by continuous flow through channels where you inject, as the stuff goes in, at some stages, you inject some reagents, and then other places you do isolation, but it's no batch. It's not a batch, right? And people won't be able to see it, but I'm just going to show you the machine. This is it. That's one view. It's basically the size of a refrigerator. It looks like it has 5 racks on which, or to which stuff is bolted, with different compartments. And it's got everything in there to form these chemicals. They chose 4 chemicals. Let me see if I can find diphenhydramine. That's a relatively simple one. I can't remember what it is, but I think it's used in, I'm sure a lot of these have a really common, Benadryl.
Oh yeah.
Lidocaine. Mm-hmm. So that's a local anesthetic, that's injected, sub-Q or intramuscularly, I guess. Diazepam. So, Valium, and fluoxetine is the most complicated one to synthesize, I think. Fluoxetine is, it's another Prozac and other, so it's an antidepressant type thing. And depending how they, so basically you have reagents, you plug in your modules to make your reagents, and then you have a little computer, and then it continuously flows through and continuously makes your reagent.
Oh, wow.
And it's something that's been used in the chemical industry, especially petroleum industry, but never for pharmaceuticals. And this is a proof of concept. We can do this. One thing they're saying is, first of all, you're going to really reduce how much waste you're making. Your ability to make stuff on demand and at the site is going to go up. You won't need these huge plants.
Right.
Be a hell of a lot cheaper. Because right now, you make the reagents in huge batches.
And then you
at
ship
one plant,
them.
And then you ship them. And another plant makes they have a special name.
So this refrigerator can do what your plant would require.
What like 3 plants would do.
Wow.
Right. And it would run continuously. Now, you'd mean many of them to scale up, but that's okay. They call them APIs, active pharmaceutical ingredient. So, for example, and it also does what's called formulation. So, you take your in batch mode at one plant, you make basic reagents, send those to somewhere else to make your API, and that would be, for example, your Benadryl, your Prozac, or whatnot. And then you still ship it to another plant for the formulation. And the formulation is all the other stuff that you put together to make it into a pill that sticks together, is not liquid. And and importantly, it's got long shelf life. And it'll do the formulation right there in it. And but they're saying, you might really get around a lot of problems, because if you can make it more locally on a smaller scale in many places, you won't need as long a shelf life because you don't need right. these huge stocks of things. And
or so, to estimate what the demand will be.
Exactly.
For a specific exactly. drug.
Exactly. So you might actually be able to make them for with different formulations, with different requirements, because they don't need to sit around. So that's a different, actually a different final product you're making. Anyway, it was really cool. Definitely a huge piece of technology. They even have like mini recrystallization and filtration setups in there.
Wow.
Yeah. Precipitation, mini precipitation, all within the thing at different spots.
I would like to see one working.
See, I mean, they have sensors all over the thing. So, you know, you've got your laptop hooked up to the side, and I'm sure it's got its custom software telling you what the pressures are at different places and temperatures. That's one thing they say is you can make chemicals using much higher concentrations. And it never occurred to me, but when you make it in batch, one of the reasons for your buffer that's there, the media you use, you know, your liquid, it's not just to hold your chemicals. It's also to help with heat transfer. In batch, you have hot spots. But when you're doing microfluidics, and it's flowing through these small channels, you have really tight control over your temperature and your pressure, which you don't in a batch.
Right.
And, well, pressure, I guess you do in a batch, but not temperature. But in a batch, you can't have very high pressure. Well, in the microfluidics, you can. Mm-hmm. And so since you have very tight control of the temperature, you can have higher temperatures than in the batch. You can have higher pressures, and you can have concentrations that are just astronomical in there because you don't need to have all this liquid to make sure to transfer the heat and stuff. So lots of interesting concepts when you go this route, different ways that you have to think about manufacturing. Very cool. See, the first author was Adamo. And I can't remember where they're from. Let's see. MIT? University of Diage? Looks like a bunch of places. Decatur, Georgia? Wow. Some of these are pharmaceutical company people. Anyway, main one is MIT, it looks like. Yep. Anyway, what do you have?
Okay, we went to a Trilog meeting the other night.
Yep, in Raleigh at NC State.
Right, and we got to hear...
So Trilog is a Linux user group for the Triangle area.
Right.
Which is...
And this group in particular is really really focused on free and open source.
Mm-hmm.
And they have meetings once a month or like speakers.
I think about once a month.
Yeah, speakers once a month. And this week they had Clinton Ibadi talk about 3D printers, and
it was oh so cool.
It was amazing. It was really interesting, and he did a very good job presenting. You know, if you're going to build a 3D printer, this is how you'd go about it. These are the pitfalls that I ran into. I thought he did a very good job with keeping clarity about materials, everything that you have to consider when you're going to make a 3D printer.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I can't remember when he said he started, but basically he decided a while back he was going to build one from scratch, not, you know, make parts.
Right.
And I mean, not buy a kit or anything like that, even just make all his own parts and stuff. And it's obvious he has learned an amazing amount.
Right. And
going through the process.
It was also obvious that that was part of the purpose of his project, is to better understand it. And it's just, I appreciated him as just an avid learner.
Yeah.
Of, you know.
He had a really... You can tell he understood how important material properties were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How flexible things are, their actual geometry, and what that means under different conditions, temperature effects, vibration, and so on.
Right.
So, tolerances.
Yeah. Tolerances, Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's one thing when you go, it was my first time at the Trilog meeting. And so I didn't know what to expect. I expected someone to be prepared and that to present to all these people. But when I went in, and I'll read the way the bios that Clinton put up about himself. So when you go in, you see a kilt-wearing, cat-loving, free software enthusiasts standing up in front of you, talking to you about 3D printers. It's like, it's interesting how you can have such a diverse group and very
that
focused.
That group is fantastically diverse.
I love how
well, except we were talking as we were going, there's not many women there.
No, not many women, but you know, there's,
but there's young people, there's old people.
And it's just a nice diversity of of people there. Anyway, but I thought he did a fantastic job. And one of the things that I had not considered is the three different software programs that you would have to kind of...
Or more than three.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
I was writing them down because I got... I'm like, okay... One, to program the actual board, so the little chip on your board, and that you would use this kind of program for. But then you need to use another one to actually accept the OpenSCAD. And it was just, it was really remarkable to think of all these things working in tangent with each other.
I can't find my notes. They must be on the other computer.
Yeah. But anyway, he actually, if you go to the Trilog Triangle Linux Users group online, you will find his entire list of materials, all his video presentation that he presented the other night. And I thought he did a fantastic job. He made me consider building our own 3D printer. And at the same time, like, that's stupid. You don't want to do all of that. But it was just, he...
It's like anything else.
Yeah.
It's in a vacuum, it'd be an awesome idea.
Oh, yeah.
Or just doing too much.
Yeah. It was just very interesting to hear
it does make
all
you
the things he had to think. Consider. And after completing his project, presenting this to a group, you had a good place, a good source to go to where you could start to consider all the best options instead of every option out there. And, he really, he's really concerned about the, cheaper kits being put out very quickly that just would never work when they're put together for the 3D printers. And he liked, what was the project?
I don't have my notes on here.
He liked the rewrap project, riprap project, where their kits, or not their kits, but their projects, he thought they were very good. And they were a place where he started. And I love the print it forward programs. People will send you printed pieces if you don't have a 3D printer to print yours. But then when you build your 3D printer, you're expected to print it forward for someone else. I just thought that was so much fun and a really cool. interesting component to add.
Yeah.
Anyway, worth checking out. And I thought he did a fantastic job.
So I have to bring up just one thing out of science, because at one point they were talking about vibrations and the noises that the printers make. And there, just a few days before I had seen out of the April 8th issue of Science, this, it's again a news piece, it's not the original article, but it's about these people that they printed three different objects and recorded the sounds. And from the sound recording and some math they did before they had done the recording to figure out, you know, what the sounds mean, they were able to recreate the code to create the three objects. And one of them was a cube. I can't remember. The other one was some other basic shape. And one was a key.
Mm-hmm.
And it had everything to do with industrial espionage, where you could go into a plant and see 3D stuff being printed and recorded, and it was kind of fun.
Oh, and the other thing that I really liked that was mentioned there is that when you are building a 3D printer, they do not come with a safety code. You know, and we know that when we build things.
As soon as you start building seriously, you know there's all sorts of stuff you have to be careful about, because you're on your own.
Right.
Right. As soon as you start doing things, and then it just becomes part of your nature. You know, some people still do stupid things, but you know, if someone's going to not buy finished product, there's no way to come up with anything to stop them from hurting themselves. That's the point, is you're developing new stuff, so.
No, I know. It's just, I thought it was worth mentioning, especially with their heat plate, and Clinton mentioning that he did have minor fires too.
Right.
And, you know, it's just to keep in mind when you're adjusting
that heat plate. Oh, this is serious stuff. Sure.
Yeah. And also his mention about that laser cutter, which would be really awesome to print as well, but not to hang off of your 3D printer. So it's just, you know, I thought he did a great job mentioning those things. Yeah, so he did a fully designed RepRap project. Okay, so that's everything.
That's all the science and tech.
Mm-hmm. And now we're to what kept you so busy last week, Patrick?
Well, first, to get out of the way, we finally got our results for the O-Meet out. I really should have either figured out the program or written one up like I did last year when I couldn't get it to run. But anyway, too busy, and I was halfway through before I realized this is going to take too long. Anyway, that's out. The stuff on the webpage has been on hold. And we'll be until tomorrow.
Right.
Because we've got to prepare. This whole last... Well, it's not last week. I got back Monday evening. But the week before, I was in Texas for the U.S. ARDF Championships there. Put on by Ken and Jen Harker. It was a fantastic event. Just absolutely phenomenal people there, and I don't know, just a lot of fun. Having just been there and writing up flyers for our ARDF meets, it made me really realize what it is about ARDF that is so unusual. And it's a sport, so it's really healthy. You're out doing exercise. You're outdoors, which is very cool.
Right.
It's an incredibly mentally demanding sport. And, like, you could go through it without thinking, but well, no, you couldn't. And certainly you can do a lot better by thinking. It's one way to look at it is just you have directions that you figure out, okay, transmitters are in these directions, I have to go get them, and then you just go. But in actuality, you have the terrain to contend with. You have the timing of when they come on and come off, mm-hmm. how far away they are. So you have to plan your route to try to get them all. And this is continuously going as changing as you go, right? Because you're having to figure out always where you are, figure out new directions, refigure out your timing to see, okay, am I going to get to this one on time to get to the next one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's still time to figure out where it is, and or should I wait now and figure out where they are so that when I get the next one? So, yeah, it gets very complicated. It's like complicated like orienteering, but more so as you get better. There's a whole tech type stuff to it that's really geeky, having to do with handling the receivers and
mm-hmm.
understanding what kind of information you get from them and how that's affected by the land around you, whether you have long linear conductive structures where the ground is on 80 meter, you know, those two things, and on 2 meters reflections. And so it's a real techie thing also. I was there for 4 days. There was five. Then we had a practice, two smaller events, and then mm-hmm. two classic events. So, yep.
So were there any student groups showing up at this one?
Not this time. We had individual students show up. So there's mm-hmm. a guy, Yu Chen, from mm-hmm. Texas A&M. He's a senior there. He showed up on one of the days. And trying to remember, there's some local orienteer people that showed up to try it out. And I don't know, I don't think any of them were students, but I don't know, one of them might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not like the Colorado mm-hmm. championship where all of these Chinese showed up.
Yeah.
So did that, and then showed everybody our new transmitter.
Yeah.
Which was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Showed it to a bunch of people. Got some good information about how to tackle the two meters and things to watch out for with the ones we built.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're planning our next meet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks, we're going to have one in school.
Right. In 2 weeks.
Well, not quite 2 weeks. A week and a half.
Yeah.
And then the Saturday after that. Is that our meet already?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Let me bring up our calendar.
It is moving along. I'm pretty sure that's what.
Yeah. So we're going to do the in-school one, and then the Saturday one is going to be just right 2 days after. Later.
Mm-hmm.
So
we are very excited about doing our meets at the school. Although we're both very, we aren't concerned. We aren't sure how many people are going to show up.
Yeah. Because it's really different. In school, we're having to turn kids away.
Yeah.
Because we don't have enough receivers. But you don't know how that's going to translate to this situation where their parents are going to have to drive them on a Saturday.
Right.
Like they do for soccer.
Right.
And stuff like that.
And it's different.
Yeah.
Who knows? And you don't, not many people know about ARDEV.
Yeah.
So it's just a little more challenging, or at least it's one of those things that we aren't sure how it will all play out, but we're hopeful.
Anyway, that's mm-hmm. all I have.
Great. I know that the ARDEV, being part of the ARDEV competitions at the, you know, when they come up every year, it's really important just to keep involved in that community.
For me, that's 90% of it. You know, when I go there, I really try to help out and stuff because it's about making sure I keep in touch with the community because I want to make it happen here.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just to compete, then it wouldn't be as big deal for me.
Right, right. But trying to make a community here of a diverse age group and interest is one of our future goals. And it's one of our challenges that hopefully we'll be addressing the next year.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to get quite a few receivers.
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking when we start to do the ones with the orienteers rather than the school, we'll be able to get quite a few people out on the course.
Right. Yeah. I'm hoping people really want to buy their receivers.
Well, I'm hoping parents will want to buy for their kids.
That's what I meant.
We might be able to get, you know, I think we were discussing earlier today and came to this number of 40. If we can have events where 40 kids show up, that's more, I don't want it to grow much past that.
No.
That's kind of like
the max.
unless we have parents. Well, no, even then I wouldn't want to do that every, like once a month or twice a month. I don't really want to do them more than once a month, but having them twice a month, if other people are doing rather than us, and we just need to supply the equipment and maybe just show up, then that'd be fine if we have parents volunteering. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we'll see how it goes next year.
Mm-hmm.
This year, it's just going to be getting it started.
Right.
Okay. So. Is that everything?
That is everything.
Including our future plans?
Oh, I forgot my blog.
Oh, yeah. Didn't forget. Well, I forgot to write my... Well, I didn't forget. Like, I just kept putting it off, and I'm still going to put it off. So, so you go ahead and do yours.
I'll do a very short mention. So, I have this group of students at school that have been working probably since November, getting together a plan to design and build a drone. They were very excited, and they would get together once a week, and they wanted to do this because they had been doing programming on Khan Academy, and they were like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if we could program a drone to fly and to build it so that we've made everything. And after getting the project together, and they posted it on Donors Choose as a student-led project, and it is now up and ready to be funded. And the students, even though it's posted on Donors Choose, they've gone ahead and actually started the 3D printing of the base for the drone and the different parts. So,
wow, so they've started even before the funding's come.
Yeah, so it's really exciting. I'm glad that they've done that they've taken such a...
Where's the printing happening?
At school.
Smith or the high school?
Yeah, Smith. We have a 3D printer, so they're using the one there. And their first printing, they had a few problems with a 3D printer.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't quite putting the holes at the right spot and that, but it was not calibrated. So they're going to calibrate it and redo it. But the good news is that their first draft of this drone, there wasn't very many plastic pieces, but the plastic pieces they do have, we'll be able to practice drilling on if we need to drill out holes for them to put screws through.
Right.
So it's really quite handy to have the material to practice on before you do it. So this is, it's great that students are doing this, but it's a student-led project, and so then it goes at a student pace. And that pace is the pace they decide for their group, because this is a project they're doing above and beyond their extracurriculars and their academics. And so their pacing is quite a bit slower than if they were just sitting down and working on this drone for, you know, a week.
Sure.
So, and also I've had to negotiate kind of our mode for dealing with the drone so that the parents understood that this is a big accomplishment. These students got together, they put together a plan, they wrote a grant, and they put together a parts list and posted it, and they're doing some 3D printing on the side to start to build this project up. So huge accomplishments. Will they get it built? I'm not sure. I hope so.
It's hard for people that don't build to understand what small steps just take phenomenal amounts of work.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, November, December, January, February. And, you know, of course, we've had winter break during that time. Yeah. And snow days that missed the things.
And you start doing stuff from scratch, you will have to fail.
Yeah.
There's no way that you can have every part work the first time. You're going to have some major failures. And that's the only way that you get to this point where you really know what you're talking about. Well, like Clinton, Peabody.
Like, I felt so good sitting there. Here he was.
Hearing all of the stuff that went wrong, where he changed it.
Yeah. And he said, my project should have come in around 500 to 800. I went quite a bit over that because I made choices that were wrong. Yeah. And then I had to rebuild and pretty much make two printers. But I can see that.
Totally.
You know, you start building and then you just don't have the experience that you need to.
Yeah. I can't remember who I was talking to when I was at the Art of Meat, but they were asking me, so, you know, did you do this in one shot? And I was like, well, so, you know, this was a learning experience for me. I learned how to do practically everything on each step. So I first made each part ugly construction. Then I tried to put it together. Then I had each part separately made as Oshpark modules. Then I had all of that working together. Then I had the single board made.
Right.
Well, by the time I had the single board made, I had made this so many times. And it would have taken 10 years trying to make maybe I would have never gotten through it. You know, it had to be cut into small enough pieces that when it failed, which it was going, some of them were going to fail. Mm-hmm. It wasn't such a huge thing that you could figure out, oh, it's one of these 10 things that's going to be wrong. Well, it can't be these three, intuition. Then you start testing and you can figure out. It's just the way it has to be done in order to be successful in the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to break things down into parts that can fail and that you can handle the failure.
Right, right.
With that size of a sub project, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, that's really exciting, the drone project coming along.
And honestly, you know, we're in April, so they have like 3 more months to finish it.
Yeah.
But it's okay. Like, they're in 8th grade and doing much more than 99% of the students in their grade. So I think it'll put them in a nice place for next year, whether they go into the engineering program at the high school or just do the robotics, the hobby robotics at the side. I think it'll be very cool. So that's my blog for this week.
And I think that finishes up.
Yeah, that finishes us up.
Okay, so thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.